Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today. Hi listener, this is episode 39, Adrian from Sofeast here, and today I'm joined by another special guest, Richard Barnett, who is the CMO of Supply Frame. Now, he's over there in Texas, and today we're discussing electronics supply chains, and specifically how to reduce risks and make them a lot more resilient, given everything that's going on in this past year or so and continues to be going on with the pandemic. Reducing risks, as we've said before, is more important than ever. So getting Richard's thoughts on this, given that he's got decades of experience in Asia, working in the electronics field, means that we're going to get some really great insight into how to manage those risks. So let's hear what Richard had to say. Hi, Richard. Thanks for joining me today. It's so great to have you here. Really excited to hear about your experience and everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Adrian. It's an honor and a privilege to join you and your audience today and talk about some pretty top of mind, topics for discussion around, how to manage innovation and, post-COVID, what do we expect and what are we seeing across the global electronics value chain? Tons of great questions here to dive into.
Yeah, that's sort of intro in what we're going to be going into. So thanks for that. Certainly with the framework of post-COVID as well, this is something that's always going to be really important for the listener. So before we kick off and get into some questions and really tap into your experience, could you just briefly introduce yourself and your history?
You bet. So I am currently Chief Marketing Officer at Supply Frame. And I joined Supply Frame in February of last year, which is a very interesting timing. We can get into later about right before kind of the work from home and kind of the COVID pandemic really started becoming more clear. But I started my career broadly in the software industry back in 95 and, did some time, early on working for, innovative companies that were solving sort of, very high value challenges in, say global manufacturing, high tech, using, advanced technology. So I started working with a company called Trilogy Software that focused on complex product configuration problems for telecom and, high end computing, servers, et cetera. And then went to i2 Technologies back in 97, which became a leader in the supply chain management software space, and spent most of my time starting up i2 Japan and living in Tokyo for 3 years. Wow. And supporting all of our growth in Asia Pacific as well in that role. And that's a really interesting, set of experiences for me. And also, I oftentimes refer back to those, early engagements, with key players in the industry now that were much, much smaller than they are now, going to Shenzhen in, 97, and its population was 350,000 people, going to Taipei and having conversations with Stan Shi, the founder of Acer, and, the leadership teams at Compal and Quanta, back when, they were growing fast, but they weren't, even a tenth the size that they are now. So it's the long view has been really interesting. When I left i2 Technologies, I've worked in, broadly, a few startups, but then also some, very large companies like Microsoft. And it's generally all been around, business applications, innovation around the global supply chain, around procurement, and now more recently around the design cycles and how do we use intelligence to drive greater, improved decision support, oftentimes combining, interesting insights around, how the enterprise is performing with outside intelligence from the market and combining that together to really transform, new product introduction, for example, or, strategic sourcing activities or the way that component suppliers are digitally engaging with their engineering communities. That's really where the focus has been most recently at Supply Frame.
Fascinating. Okay. And with regard to your more recent experience at Supply Frame, then how do you see this fitting in with today's
importer, you know, somebody who perhaps is an entrepreneur who's developing a new product?
Right. Well, I think that what we're really focused on at Supply Frame is taking a very large network of media properties, community sites, vertical search engines that traditionally have all related to electronic components and design, and then working with, you know, really key players in the value chains from, you know, semiconductor and component suppliers, large and small, through distributors, and then their contract manufacturing, larger contract manufacturing partners, down to the downstream, you know, OEMs, if you will, or leading, you know, global manufacturers, and these different downstream industries that are increasingly becoming electrified in terms of automotive, industrial equipment, med tech, obviously enterprise, you know, high tech and communications, all of those downstream industries, right, are kind of where we sit across that value chain. And what we're trying to do is derive new insights from literally billions of signals around demand, intent, supply, and risk, you know, across 600 million parts that we're looking at, and we're engaging with 10 million engineers and supply chain professionals every month. So that creates a digital exhaust, which we can then see and understand, you know, insights that weren't clear before in new ways, and then provide those insights in the context of, you know, for example, if you're a high-tech startup and working through your first initial product design, and you're relying on, you know, key suppliers, say in China, and other key partners in that effort. What we're really all about is providing new forms of intelligence to accelerate that product design, identify and de-risk key part component selections in the design phase, and then think about how to align for your ramp to volume, given the constraints and the risks that are in the overall value chain. And that's really what we're focused on.
And the word that you're using, risk, I mean, this is something that really, really chimes in with a lot of the things that Renault and I have been talking about on the podcast, and indeed Renault's been writing about on the website, on the various blogs that we've got. And reducing risk, whether it's in a global electronic supply chain or any kind of supply chain, is probably now, you may agree, more important than ever, given the landscape that we find ourselves in over the last couple of years.
We hope so. And what I mean by that is we've been talking about various forms of risk, you know, in different industries, particularly in high tech, for a long time. But, you know, there's some institutionalized dynamics that I think we're finally seeing fundamentally shift, right? So if you look at, you know, this kind of over-focused on cost efficiency, you know, outside the balance of profitability, value, and risk or resiliency, you know, there's a shift that's happening where that shift is now towards resiliency in a balanced way, and thinking about how to de-risk products at the design phase is now, there's an increasing focus around that. And that's true for large, very large companies with very large product portfolios down to, you know, nimble, fast moving startups. You know, those issues are relevant for everyone. And we've also seen, obviously, with the pandemic, a, you know, kind of initial crisis testing of current ability to just simply adjust in react mode to the immediate changes that were occurring, whether that was, you know, manufacturing shutdowns, you know, in key markets, particularly in China, then having a ripple effect, right, across, you know, other supply chains, essentially, a lot of unexpected consequences. But you also saw demand shift, right, you know, change in mix of demand. You know, we saw demand for automobiles go way down, but we saw massive spikes in, you know, work from home tech and, you know, fueling, accelerating digital services capacity at data centers, right? So all of that unfolded over a very, very short period of time. And whenever that happens, I think, you know, when we're in these crisis moments, it does help, you know, folks to think more deeply about how are they organized? You know, what did they just learn about going through this crisis? You know, how can they do it better next time? You know, how do they need to collaborate better across their ecosystem? What forms of intelligence are really useful when you're going through this, you know, set of changes? And that's generally, even though it's painful, you know, leaders come out of that cycle being much stronger and sometimes with real competitive advantage against others because they've shifted the way they're doing things to take stock of what they've just learned. And I do think we're going to see, I'm optimistic, I do think that we're going to see a new set of positive changes, generally speaking, occur over the next 2 to 3 years in the next normal, so to speak.
Okay, the next normal. You've gone through a number of risks as you see them. I mean, are you able to give me a kind of more exhaustive list of some of the risks which have exhibited themselves? And you mentioned the pandemic specifically. Of course, everybody's kind of been touched by that. And I would like you to speak about, you know, the effects of coronavirus. But what else are you seeing in terms of risk that that perhaps we can illuminate for the listener so they can consider avoiding these?
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, you can look at risk from multiple different dimensions, right? So what's unique about the pandemic is that it is a non-commercial risk to supply chains, meaning it's an externality that, you know, is really related to health and, you know, primarily, you know, has nothing to do with underlying macroeconomic, you know, conditions that were pre-existing per se, or you know, unforecastable, you know, weather events, et cetera, that are sort of, you know, event-based or, you know, predictable and potentially avoidable risks that relate to things like supply lead times and constraints in the market, you know, that's complicated because it's multi-tier, but all these kind of, you know, risk dimensions really came alive during the pandemic. But I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of you know, a compounding, almost cascading set of risk, you know, issues that were still, you know, driving massive volatility in supply markets in the high tech value chain or electronics value chain, even before the pandemic occurred. So we saw issues related to, you know, changing tariff agreements, retaliatory tariffs between the US and China, you know, bilateral tariff tensions between Korea and Japan, you know, shifting trade balance between, you know, new trade agreements being formed, you know, transitioning down to TPP, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We could go on and on, right? But there's these geopolitical factors which are increasingly important to consider, you know, in addition to the normal cyclicality of capital intensive aspects of the electronics industry, such as fab production and capacity or the technology life cycle of, you know, memory and storage and you know, these specific dynamics that are, you know, you can examine just within a sub-commodity group. You know, now we have to look at all these factors in combination, and that's what makes it very difficult.
As an importer of electronics, you've got this sort of nest of different factors that you need to be considering. You've also been hit by the coronavirus. What's the way out of this for, let's say you're a business and you've been struggling with the different risks that have hit your supply chain, and there seems to be like you're still in this tunnel. Where's the light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, I think it will take some time to play out, and obviously everyone's specific situation will vary just based on the, you know, the nature of their markets that they're serving from a demand perspective, and then the nature of the, you know, the products that they're designing and manufacturing in terms of, you know, what is critical to design, where are their key, you know, potential risk areas from a supply, you know, commodity group, and then, you know, the visibility and sort of resiliency that's being designed in into the supply chain. So, you know, breaking that apart, you know, one of the key questions is where you are in your go-to-market journey and where is the, you know, the best view of the shift in demand happening, because there's a lot of, you know, potential pent-up demand, you know, as we get into, you know, more improved conditions with limited restrictions on number of aspects of, you know, getting back to normal, so to speak, with vaccines, that may have a significant uncertainty around your downstream demand, the timing for that, or what the uplift might be. So in you know, it's then important to think about how to optimize the supply chain with flexibility to maybe, you know, ramp fairly quickly to upside and minimize your downside risk. And that part of that really requires thinking through where are your opportunities for flexibility or risk sharing with your key partners. If that's a key contract manufacturer, you might want to re-explore your you know, service level agreement and your, you know, liability sharing rules and sort of thinking around that in terms of inventory, for example, or lead time. But it needs to go further. As we know, there's a complex multi-tier set of dynamics in the value chain, and we're seeing that right now play out around key components into the automotive OEM space. And, you know, it goes all the way back to foundries and fab capacity that shared, you know, for fabless semiconductor companies that use and rely on, like, say, TSMC and UMC as their key foundry partners. You know, that's just one tiny example of, you know, this ripple effect. So it's really important to kind of think through the multi-tier supply chain and where your critical potential bottlenecks are, or where you have, you know, potential risk, at, you know, at the supply base side. And then I think it's really about, you know, understanding where you can drive the biggest long-term impact. What we have found is really at the point of design. So it's very hard to re-qualify parts and suppliers after you've transitioned from a design bill of material into a manufacturing bill of material, oftentimes maybe shared with a contract manufacturer. And what we've found is that the ability to de-risk that bill of material design by qualifying in the design phase, alternate parts and suppliers, for example, so that you are pre-qualified to make transitions while it's in manufacturing, if needed, is one of the most important ways to de-risk products in this environment. So, you know, it depends on the product itself, but what we've generally found, you know, depending on the product design, is that 70 to 80% of the lifetime cost and risk of a product is designed in at the bill of material phase at the design, you know, new product introduction before release to manufacturing. And that's, so from a leverage point perspective, we believe that that's really where you start your focus to manage uncertainty right now.
Well, excellent. Some really good advice coming in here. So really grateful for that. Thank you. Earlier on, you did mention the issues between China and the US at the moment. Of course, you're in America yourself. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about the US-China trade war, as it's often known. I mean, is this a risk that you see being an ongoing issue, especially for, of course, American businesses and importers?
It's interesting because I think in general, you know, one of the things that was very clear was that with the last sort of recent history with retaliatory tariffs during the Trump administration and China, the biggest challenge was actually not the fact that the, you know, proposed tariff and the scope of, you know, products under the, you know, harmonized trade, you know, sort of codes would be, you know, HTS codes, you know, what scope, right, was being impacted, whether that was 5%, 10%, you know, or even 25%. The biggest challenge was uncertainty, because they were going back and forth. There was a lot of threats, and then there was a compromise, and you could see this play out over a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And what really kills supply chains is not just so much specifically a change in tariffs. It is the uncertainty associated with the cost profile. And what that uncertainty led to was generally most large global manufacturers seeking to partially diversify outside of China, either final assembly locations and shifting to a regional or nearshoring for final assembly. Mm-hmm. And then potentially looking at, you know, tier one suppliers, at least finding, you know, multiple manufacturing tier one supplier locations. So sources of supply were increasingly less single sourced, multi-sourced, and then also potentially multi-sourced out of China, just from a geography perspective. But if we looked at the total impact of the quote unquote transition out of China over the last 2 to 3 years, I mean, it's been less than 10% for on aggregate, right? So this notion that, decoupling could occur quickly is just, not reality, right? Mm. Even if there was, ratcheting up of even more intense, negotiations related to tariffs between China and the United States, what we would see is a combination of absorbing the cost, the increased cost of components into products, which would reduce the net margin for that manufacturer, for that brand company, and or passing those costs on to consumers. And we saw both really transpire without significant shifts in demand for most companies in their categories, right? There was a fair amount of elasticity, if you will, around absorbing both the cost and price changes. And I think we would see more of the same. I think the risk, Deutsche Bank has an interesting study that, fund almost that they're looking at, composite fund that's looking at the tech Cold War, right? And they look at the total cost of decoupling being, over $3.5 trillion over a few years, right? If that's the total extreme, right, of what would happen. I just, regardless of the rhetoric and regardless of very reasonable opportunities for negotiation around, for example, improved IP protection for external manufacturers looking to build and partner and create joint ventures within China, and then improved transparency, and potentially, different improved regulations regarding labor, worker safety, material composition, et cetera. All of those are the normal things that you look for ongoing negotiations in trade agreements. And we've saw that with, the former NAFTA agreement, getting renegotiated in a similar way. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, also had the same scope of negotiating elements in there. So I think that what we're going to see is re-engagement, a re-looking at the same open issues that are there, probably less uncertainty than what we saw with the Trump administration, probably a little bit more visibility to a clear policy goal and structure. But I think the real term risks around, unexpected, sort of changes in tariffs is relatively low, particularly when you compare it to the other, more interesting sort of, in my opinion, sort of dynamics that are going on that are not necessarily impacted directly by trade policy.
Okay. And could you elaborate on what some of those would be?
Well, I think 2021, is becoming almost a perfect storm year of, we're coming out of COVID restrictions. We've got demand has dramatically shifted from, like I talked about earlier, just, spiky growth immediate in consumer technology and in working from home and digital services, hyperscale computing demand has really gone through the roof. And then we're seeing the industries that were directly impacted coming back online, like automotive, downstream hospitality, et cetera, just the general economic recovery. You have kind of a V-shaped recovery of demand. And all that's coming at a time where you've got, a capital kind of expenditure pattern going in where there's increasing capital expenditures within, large foundry and fab, but real capacity limitations there. And you're seeing a shift in key component commodity categories around a reallocation of demand, not even within among customers, but across industries. So a general shift, for example, of passives, multi-layer ceramic capacitors that we saw constrained in 2018, now being allocated into other industries that have higher reliability and profitability, moving, say, from consumer electronics into, say, automotive or med tech, right? And so you're seeing this kind of allocation shift and increasing lead times that then is impacting downstream industries and is not something that you can work your way out of very quickly. I mean, the issues that the automotive OEMs are facing relate to some standard ICs that just simply got consumed by, other industries, and to a large degree, or they had ASICs or custom, designs of chipsets that, you know, go into mobility systems and auto systems, et cetera, that now are severely constrained, you know, in terms of weeks because of the lead time constraints that they have. And this is impacting directly, you know, automobile production schedules, because that entire industry is built on a just-in-time, just-in-sequence model from a supply chain perspective at the final assembly point, but then doesn't have very clear ways to buffer variability for long lead time or highly volatile demand upstream. They push that liability to their tier one suppliers and upstream. And you see this kind of playing out in different ways in different industry value chains, that there's a kind of a resetting of what is just in case versus just in time. What is the appropriate inventory buffer? How do I negotiate my agreements to provide greater flexibility and balanced risk sharing versus just chasing lowest cost, you know, and at all times, right, for total landed costs? Like that, there's a shift in decision making that's, you know, you see occurring across multiple value chains and will continue to play out through this year. But I think this year is more interesting from a constraint perspective than I've seen probably really since the 1999, 2000, 2001 B2B bubble burst cycle that we saw, you know, going back 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think with everything that's gone on, there's definitely had to become quite a change in outlook for people who are importing. I mean, some companies were very hard hit when the pandemic first hit. I guess in many ways, perhaps they just weren't prepared to and hadn't really looked at how to make their supply chain more resilient.
Well, it was such an externality. Like I said, this is a non-commercial, you know, yeah, risk event, right? And so even the largest companies really have no business continuity planning around pandemic response. I mean, it might have even been in their insurance policies, but they certainly weren't operationally planning for that. Now, that may change. But if you're a smaller, earlier stage or startup, you know, kind of, you know, targeting a very specific market and looking to scale and grow, I think the risks have been substantial and far exceeded anyone's ability to buffer, right, you know, that risk. So it's really more about aligning and trying to synchronize with recovery, with the best view of what's driving demand, and really look at doing everything you can to reconfirm your understanding of supply lead time, you know, flexibility around upside, where your key bottleneck constraints are. And then, like I said, maybe potentially going back to the design phase and doing a design review of those active bills of material to make them, you know, kind of built in more resiliency and in that design itself, and maybe going through a quick design review.
I mean, those really are the tips to take away for businesses who are developing a new product in 2021, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Richard, you mentioned design to source intelligent earlier on in the podcast. So could you tell me a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, we've really, when we were looking at all of the reach that we had from a, you know, network perspective, whether that's, you know, looking at standard parametric data and engineering content across 600 million parts, or, you know, the search activities of engineers and sourcing professionals, or how we can see new design cycles being developed globally. This year, what we realized, last year in 2020, what we did is we realized that it's really all about a new form of intelligence that we're able to aggregate and analyze. And we think that, you know, this design to source intelligence, which is really all about how do you, you know, look at multiple information sources from these very large, you know, big data sources now that we have, you know, across either our network or that we can tap into, and then really distill down leading indicators of demand and engineering activity and popularity of where we think the market's going to be going. And then some very interesting triangulation around lagging indicators around supply lead times and what might be correlated with changes in capacity, changes in price and cost, you know, and where that trending is happening, and combine that in and push new forms of insight into both the design process, you know, as well as managing the operational supply chain over time. And I think this is, you know, we're excited about what we're doing here, but it's an interesting way of a pattern that we see happening across other industries. And it's really a mindset where you want to remain very curious and look outside in for new forms of insight that might influence your decisions, because typically the information you have, you know, based on your own experience, your own enterprise systems, is very limited and doesn't, you know, have the new information that you need to kind of, you know, be vibrant and adaptive in this new resiliency, right, that's required to be effective in the global electronics value chain. So, you know, one takeaway is just in general is folks to, you know, be very curious, look at new forms of information that you may have access to through your partners or through these networks of information that are now coming online.
Yeah, wise words. That's really great, and I'm so happy you're able to give that sort of tangible takeaway for the listeners, because this is what it's all about. This is why I wanted to get you on and tap into that experience. So yeah, I've really enjoyed everything that you've had to share today, Richard. It's been brilliant.
Thank you so much, Adrian, for the opportunity, continue the good work on sharing these insights particularly for importers and others that are looking to constantly improve their business models around how they work with key suppliers and partners in China.
Yeah, well, we'll surely do that. And for anybody that is listening and you want to hear a little bit more about Supply Frame, you can actually find Supply Frame at supplyframe.com. I will add the link to that to the show notes so everybody can go and have a look at that there.
Excellent.
All right, Richard, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you.
So much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.